I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. John Boehner surprised a lot of people when he announced last Friday that he was stepping down at the end of October as Speaker of the House. Here he is last Sunday on Face the Nation complaining about the conservatives in his own party and the 17-day government shutdown of 2013.
You know, the Bible says beware of false prophets. And there are people out there, you know, spreading noise about how much can get done. I mean, this whole idea that we're going to shut down the government to get rid of Obamacare in 2013, this plan never had a chance. But over the course of the August recess in 2013 and the course of September, you know, a lot of my Republican colleagues who knew it was a fool's errand, really, they were getting all this pressure from home to do this. And so we got groups here in town, members of the House and Senate here in town, who whip people into a frenzy believing they can accomplish things that they know are never going to happen.
The threatened government shutdown this fall isn't going to happen either. After weeks of Republican infighting, Congress passed a stopgap measure yesterday to fund federal agencies until December 11th, when Congress will no doubt battle over government spending all over again. Well, joining us to talk about all of this is Jim Manley, Director of Communications for QGA Public Affairs. That's a bipartisan political consulting firm. He previously served as senior aide to Senator Minority Leader Harry Reid, also as press secretary for Senator Ted Kennedy. And Jim Manley, nice to have you with us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity to come on.
Also with us is Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post. And Robert Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I should say, Robert, joining us from the studios of The Washington Post. Robert, was Boehner jumped? Was Boehner pushed or did he jump?
It was a little bit of both. Boehner has had a tumultuous run as Speaker of the House ever since he took over in January of 2011. And he was facing what we call a motion to vacate the chair, which is a motion by a member, could be privileged, which means it would have to come up to a vote, that would effectively put the speakership up for a vote. And Boehner, knowing his unpopularity with many of his own members, he didn't want to put his members through that ordeal. At the same time, he's been dealing with a conference for years now that really doesn't want to listen. And I think he just reached his breaking point. Perhaps Pope Francis's visit helped him nudge him to the door. But he saw the writing on the wall for a long time.
Jim, you have worked with John Boehner in the past. Yeah. I guess when you worked with Ted Kennedy, probably also with Harry Reid. What was he like to work with?
Yeah, I mean, you and your readers need to understand, I spent a lot of time, or your listeners rather, I spent a lot of time with then chairman of the Education and Workforce Committee, John Boehner, when he worked with Senator Kennedy on a whole host of legislation, including No Child Left Behind, pension reform legislation, reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. He's a good and honest man who is not afraid to compromise, or at least he was then. But in his current iteration as Speaker, not only could he never reach a compromise, but he also couldn't deliver the votes as well. So when I worked for Senator Reid liked him on a personal level, but, you know, he was very skeptical that if Speaker Boehner said that he was going to be able to bring a deal to the floor, you know, that he was going to be able to bring the votes to deliver. So, again, a good man who was caught in a horrible situation. And I think he made the right decision at this point in time.
Jim, was he a bad speaker or was it just an impossible job for him?
I'm not going to cut him any slack at this point in time. A little bit of both. The fact of the matter is that if he wanted to, he could have reached beyond his caucus and cut deals with House Democrats. But in a mistake of epic proportion, he usually stuck to a rule. It's called the Hastert rule, that he would only take legislation to the floor if it had a majority of his caucus. Ergo, very few, if any, bipartisan bills ever made to the floor, and very few ever made to the Senate and or to the president for his signature. So, to be crystal clear, that was a decision that he made. He didn't have to live with it. And he decided to do so. But in the end, I do have to concede that you know, there's a significant part of his caucus that's all but ungovernable. When I worked for Senator Kennedy, I saw a man who didn't think that the word compromise was a bad in and of itself. He believed, I believe correctly, that it's always better to get half a loaf right now and then work to try and build on your successes further on down the road. There's a whole bunch of House Republicans who, you know, they've got a highway or the my way or the highway mentality. They believe that compromise is a dirty word, and they furthermore believe that, you know, based in part in the fact that they got elected by their constituents, they were elected to come here and try and burn the place down. So a little bit of both.
Well, let me pick up on that. To you, Robert Costa, I think Jim Manley is talking about the Freedom Caucus. This is, what, 30 to 40 members of Congress, very conservative. I've heard some of them being interviewed over the last couple of days, very happy that Speaker Boehner will be gone at the end of the month. One of them saying, we need a speaker who can stand up to the president. I mean, essentially, we came here to represent our constituents, and we will not compromise.
It's been fascinating to watch, though, because the Freedom Caucus, in many ways, has responsibility for Boehner leaving. Their decision to move against him constantly, the threat of the Freedom Caucus causing some kind of trouble, it was a cloud over Boehner's entire speakership. But when the time came this past week for the Freedom Caucus to have its own candidate stand for speaker, no one has emerged. I mean, this has been a real struggle for the conservative flank for a long time. They want to have influence, they want to have power, and they do have both. But when it comes to actually being in the leadership and enforcing the leadership fight and installing one of their own, they've had real difficulties. And so the next speaker, in many ways, if it's Kevin McCarthy, the easygoing Californian, the majority leader looking to move up the ladder, he's going to be dealing with the same problems with the Freedom Caucus, a base that's spoiling for a fight with the president. But as a reporter, I'd just like to say quickly, the biggest issue here is not ideology. Okay, the Republican Party today, almost to a T, believes similar things, broadly speaking. The ideology has moved to the right. The party is more to the right. What the real disagreements are within the GOP are about what divided government means, what can be accomplished within divided government. The current leadership with Boehner always said there are limitations about what can be accomplished. The Freedom Caucus types, they wanted to achieve more with a Democratic president. And those tensions about what can be actually accomplished here are what drove all of this drama.
And I do want to throw that to Jim Manley, but let me ask you a question, Robert Costa, because Speaker Boehner, I guess, allowed members of the House to vote more than, what, 30 or 40 times to defund the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Was that an effort on his part to sort of mollify this wing of his party?
History is going to have different interpretations. I think Jim brought up a very valid point that Boehner had the opportunity to push the conference in a different direction at numerous points. But and as Boehner said in his interview, he was always just trying to do what he thought it was the best he could to control an unruly bunch. But history will wonder, could Boehner have done more to engage with the president, to keep his own members in line? Boehner is a man of the institution, but he's not really a party man, and he didn't have political capital at many key moments to push his people in a certain direction.
I mean, Jim, what does divided government mean? I mean, in certain ways, I guess we've been living through it.
Yes. Well, a couple different things. First of all, while it's true that some members of the so-called House Freedom Caucus are focusing their ire at President Obama, what I find fascinating as a Senate institutionist, I spent 21 years as a Senate staffer, that most of the time they spend most of their time they're arguing against Senate Republicans, members of their own party. That's been a constant refrain from soon-to-be Speaker McCarthy in recent days. He's going to run against Senate Republicans. So why does that matter? Nothing is going to change with Senate Republicans. They can complain all they want. They can ratchet up all the rhetoric they want. They can demand that the Senate change the filibuster rule. They can say all of that until the cows come home, but nothing fundamentally has changed with this move. If they continue to send bad pieces of the legislation, extremist, over-the-top, Obamacare-funded related legislation, cuts to the budget, all of them are going to die a close, a quick, painful death in the Senate and never make it to the president. Why? Because Senator McConnell has got one goal and one goal only, and that's he wants to win in 2016. And to do so, he's going to have to protect his vulnerable members who want nothing to do with the circus that's going on in the over in the House right now. So, yes, it's divided government. You know, we could spend hours talking about whether that's the best way to go or not. But the fact of the matter is, not only are we seeing an argument within the House Republican caucus, but we're seeing a significant debate between House and Senate Republicans. And like I said, nothing's going to change. The only one that is taking up the talking points of the, again, so-called House Freedom Caucus is Ted Cruz. And he's as isolated within his own caucus as any member has ever been that I've seen in my 21 years in the Senate.
Robert, I think I might have asked you this question a couple of months ago. Does anyone in the Senate, any Republicans in the Senate, like Senator Ted Cruz?
There was a line I've heard from several senators recently that even Batman has lost Robin. And the reason that means Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who's close buddies with Senator Cruz, even he is distancing himself from his conservative ally. Cruz is, in essence, a man alone. But I would say he's a man alone by choice because of his presidential campaign, because of the way he postures with the conservative base. He relishes being what he sees as the outsider railing against the establishment. And McConnell has done a lot to consolidate his power, and he's used the shutdown as a leverage point in private discussions to say, you don't want to go through that again, I don't want to go through that again, let's find a different path.
About a minute before our first break here, let me go back to you, Robert, because I was reading that the Republicans have the largest majority in Congress since Herbert Hoover. I don't know if that's right or not, but obviously a clear majority in both houses of Congress. And yet their problem seems to be with themselves and each other rather than the Democratic Party.
It's true. And these are the biggest majorities since the Roaring Twenties. And you think a party with those kind of numbers and coming off a 2014 midterm sweep would be celebrating.
Right.
But you have a presidential field dominated by three outsiders with very little political experience. You have a Congress that just kicked out a speaker who led them to major gains in 2010. And the party at the moment is a party divided. It's a party that really has lost its institutional core, doesn't have really an establishment. I don't even appreciate that phrase anymore, the Republican establishment, because the donors, the party players, they have very little power. It's a grassroots party. It's a coalition, and a coalition that moves in many directions.
Well, I want to pick up on all of that. Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post. Also with us is Jim Manley. He served as senior aide to Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. He was also press secretary for Senator Ted Kennedy. As he said, understands and has great experience with the U.S. Senate. He's currently director of communications for QGA Public Affairs. That's a bipartisan political consulting firm. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, the hour we set aside to talk about politics and political issues and much to talk about. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jim Manley and with Robert Costa. Well, the name that keeps coming up to replace House Speaker John Boehner is Kevin McCarthy. And I do want to play a clip. This is Kevin McCarthy speaking with Sean Hannity about the political effect of the Benghazi Committee investigation. Let's give it a listen.
Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee. A select committee. What are her numbers today? Her numbers are dropping. Why? Because she's untrustable. But no one would have known any of that had happened had we not
thought
and made that happen.
That's something good. I give you credit for that. I give you credit for sequestration. I'll give you credit where credit is due.
Jim, let me get you a response to that. I thought the Benghazi committee was supposed to figure out why four Americans were killed in Libya. And what we hear from Kevin McCarthy is that his pleasure in the fact that it has hurt Hillary Clinton's chances as president.
As a Democratic strategist, all I can say is soon-to-be Speaker Kevin McCarthy, thank you for being so blunt and honest. I'm not so sure I expect much more honesty out of him in the weeks and months to come, but he sure nailed it at this one. This is going to be the gift that keeps on giving. He tried to walk back his statements last night with, I believe, a little effect. I personally believe that what happened there is a tragedy, and it needs to be, you know, if problems were there, people need to be held accountable. But I think this so-called committee is a phony and fraud as long as by the day is long. And I'm glad to see that this McCarthy let the cat out of the bag. Now, whether this damages within himself within this caucus remains to be seen. You know, you another powerful chairman, House Republican chairman, kind of called on McCarthy to repudiate those statements, which a little bit unusual for a chairman to say that to the soon-to-be speaker. But, you know, again, the Clinton campaign did a, you know, full-court press yesterday. They invited me to get on a call to talk about it. They're going to make the most out of it, no doubt about it.
Robert, did he hurt himself his chances for a speaker, or perhaps hurt whoever is running or will end up running against probably Hillary Clinton for the presidency?
If anything, more of the latter. For the former, McCarthy is going to easily ascend to the speakership. There's only a long shot contender against him, Daniel Webster, a conservative from Florida. He tried to run for speaker earlier this year against Boehner, got 12 votes. So McCarthy, it's amazing, doesn't have a challenger, doesn't have a rival. But I think Jim brings up some points that are really troubling Republicans nationally, especially longtime officials, because they see in McCarthy a real political operator, a talent, someone who's good at building relationships in the House. But there's also an open question of, is McCarthy ready? He only became majority whip in 2010. Suddenly in 2014, Eric Cantor loses his primary. Mm-hmm. He climbs up the ladder to majority leader. Now Boehner steps down, and he's looking to be speaker at age 50. This is someone who's not been in the House for a long time at all, and he's now going to be third in line to the presidency.
Third in line to the presidency. I mean, is it? I kind of put the same question to Jim, but is it just that this is an impossible job, or does it require certain kind of skills that past speakers didn't need to have? Can I put that to you, Robert?
Sure. I think it's a little bit of both. I think in the 24/7 media age, a speaker now has to be a public face, and we see McCarthy already struggling with that responsibility. And I think to understand what the speakership has become today, you don't need to look to McCarthy, who's someone who's really just in place to be the successor, but look at Paul Ryan. He would be a natural candidate to be the next Speaker of the House, a Ways and Means Committee chairman. He's been on the national party ticket. He is popular with members. He could be a vigorous force for the Republican Party, yet he decides to not become Speaker. He has all the support if he wanted to do it, but because the job is a management one, because it demands all this travel and fundraising, many people don't want the job. So Paul Ryan was willing to be Vice President of the United States, but Speaker of the House, no thanks.
Interesting. Jim, let me ask you, when I was reading about Kevin McCarthy and the fact that he seems to have good relationships with people in Congress, he gives out, I think, jackets or something, part of the team.
Yeah, that was in the New York Times today, yeah.
It was, and I thought that was interesting. And I wanted to ask you, do you think it's harder to be Speaker because you can't do earmarks anymore? I mean, Johnson, I guess, was famous for, you know, giving out earmarks, and we know about Bridges to Nowhere and things like that.
Senator Reid, there's no bigger fan of earmarks than my former boss, Senator Reid.
Right, I mean, because this is how you kind of sweeten deals and, I guess, get people to go along with
it's
a tool. So without these tools, can you do the job?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tool that, among other things, allows members to go back to their districts and say, look, this is what I did for you tangibly, so reelect me. So, look, I don't want to overstate the case, but it is a tool, it is a piece of leverage that has been used in the past to try and build up majorities. There's no doubt about it. But the fundamental issue, going back to something I said earlier, is that, you know, we have to concede that these, again, so-called House Freedom Caucus members and a few others, you know, hard right conservatives, were in fact elected by their constituents
right
to come to Washington to operate in this form or fashion. So until we deal with that and try and figure out how to adjust to it, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to change. But Speaker, soon-to-be Speaker McCarthy may be a nice guy, and he may have good relationships with House Republicans, but he's an unknown quantity to Leader Pelosi. He's an unknown quantity to the president, and an unknown quantity to Senator Reid as well, which is a dangerous mix as we head into the fall when there's going to be the need for leadership from the Speaker to try and cut deals and all the pending deals facing the country, including, you know, the debt limit, need to fund the government, you know, and a whole host of other issues.
I thought
I'm
Robert,
very skeptical that that's, in fact, going to be the case.
Robert, I thought it was the Democrats who were famous for fighting with each other. Is there something about being a majority that, and perhaps a majority creates diversity, but that being a majority that creates infighting?
It does. The Republicans, the conservative ones at least, seem to almost prefer opposition to be in the minority. I mean, you had Jim DeMint, the former South Carolina senator, now head of the Heritage Foundation. He's expressed the sentiment many times. He'd rather have a minority full of true blue conservatives than a majority that had to govern and deal with moderates. And so there is that strain, that current running through the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is having trouble because of its majorities. I think that's a fair point. And it's brought all these new people into the fold, not so much ideologically different, but a lot of amateur politicians, people who got elected in 2010, whether they were youthful or not, they were new to the game. They didn't even want to play the game.
Right.
And they came to Washington because of their opposition purely to President Obama. And I've encountered so many members, especially this week, just saying we need to do more against the president. And they've been here for 5 or 6 years and eternally frustrated.
I mean, what more can they do or do they want to do to the president?
Well, we have something called a constitution, and they believe in it, that's for sure. But I think they are frustrated that by the president's veto ability. They think if only the Senate Republicans and if only the House leadership could come together and force the president's hand, they could get what they want. And that's come up recently with Planned Parenthood. If we do this together in a certain way, in an aggressive way, the president will be forced to stand down. But the White House chuckles at this kind of perspective, and that the president has power to curb this kind of effort. And the Republicans, instead of dealing within the limits of divided government, as they did in the 90s with Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, and cut deals down the center, they've just stayed on the right trying to toss arrows and rocks at the administration politically.
And that's
Marty,
it. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Take a ever so slight exception
of
what
course. Go
Bob
ahead.
Just said. I see a lot of ire focused on, again, as a 21-year staffer in the Senate, maybe a little sensitive, but I see a lot of ire focused on the president, which is all well and good. But what I find fascinating is all of the bile and angry rhetoric focused on the Senate. You know, Senate Republicans are becoming, you know, a persona non grata, if you will, within the House Republican caucus. They keep on harping on the fact that if only the Senate Republicans acted, they get this stuff to the president to be vetoed. Now, you know, one of the problems with Bob's analysis is that none of this stuff is getting to the president to be vetoed.
That's true.
It's all dying in the Senate. And the last time I checked, I could be wrong, I'm pretty sure that the Republicans ran the Senate. But they're running into a little bit of a problem, that is House Republicans, with a little thing called the Senate rules. As much as they don't like it, it requires consensus to get something out of the Senate and to the president to be vetoed. And if you don't get that consensus, it's just going to die in the Senate. Now, of course, I wouldn't be doing my job as a partisan if I didn't point out that Senate Republicans were the ones that broke the Senate in years past when they filibustered everything in sight, starting with the very beginning of the Obama administration. So, you know, whether it's reap what you sow or whatever, but that is a fact right now. So the president can't even veto stuff if it doesn't get to him. And until Senate House Republicans figure that out and try and work with Senate Republicans to try and moderate some of their positions and some of their pieces of the legislation to try and pick up Senate Democrats. And I swear to God, depending on the issue, there's going to be five or six Democrats that would vote for some of this stuff. But these guys just can't figure it out.
Robert Costa, kind of a clash of two cultures here?
It is. And Jim's perceptions of the Senate are so helpful because that is often forgotten in these talks about the Republican Party. It is not so much just the president versus the Congress. It is the president versus the House versus the Senate and the president. And I think McConnell is a key figure now. Can he guide McCarthy? Can he be a senior statesman in a sense and keep this Republican Party, at least congressionally, on track? And because there are limits to what McConnell can do with the rules, and there are limits to what McConnell can do politically. And that's going to be a key test because Boehner and McConnell had a stable relationship. I wouldn't say they were overly chummy. And McCarthy and McConnell have to build that.
That's Robert Costa again, a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Jim Manley, director of communications for QGA Public Affairs, a bipartisan political consulting firm. And it's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, essentially putting, I guess, Congress Republicans on the couch in this hour of the show. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you want Congress to do, what you see happening between the two parties and certainly between the two branches of Congress. Jim, let me go back to you. And Planned Parenthood was mentioned. Of course, Cecile Richards was grilled a couple of days ago before a congressional committee about Planned Parenthood, about these edited videos. Is that a risky thing, you think, for the Republicans to do, to take on Planned Parenthood?
Well, if you look at the polls, it certainly is. In the strange but true category, I believe it was recently a recent Wall Street Journal poll put it at the top of trusted institutions. Let's put it this way. This hearing was so bad, even some of the Republicans' erstwhile allies blanched at how over the top it was. It was obvious from the very beginning they had no interest of getting the truth, and it was simply an attempt to mount a full frontal assault on Planned Parenthood. The backlash was quick and significant, though maybe not so significant that's going to stop them from moving forward. There's now a discussion of setting up a select committee within the House to investigate Planned Parenthood. You know, obviously I'm the wrong guy to ask.
I mean, sure, I understand.
Reince Priebus, you know, the head of the RNC in 2012, they did an autopsy where they pledged to try and change the tone and tenor of the Republican Party, and whether it's immigration, the war on women, assault on abortion, they've not learned their lesson. So,
well, to you, Robert, though, listening to the back and forth at this hearing, was this also designed to kind of secure the base of the Republican Party and perhaps the base that we've been talking about?
Yes and no. The lateness of this committee being set up really reflects the indecision in the leadership about how they wanted to handle this and whether it would be too political. And you saw Boehner always trying to make sure that it didn't become something that was partisan, at least in how it was described. Of course, it would sound partisan at times in the actual hearings and the procedure. But McCarthy has pulled on under the rug of that, and it's hurt the party, at least for the next few days. And it may hurt the party and what it's able to achieve when Secretary Clinton comes to Capitol Hill. I think that with the Benghazi experience, though, you have Republicans back in their districts, just like when Boehner talked about in that interview in 2013, the base just wanted a shutdown.
Yeah.
They just wanted it. With Benghazi, they wanted select committees. They wanted some kind of really aggressive effort against this to investigate it. And to me, that's the whole part of the Republican debate right now. It's not just about should they go after Obamacare in 2013 or in 2014 and 2015, should they pursue Benghazi. It's about how they do it, and how they do it has caused so much internal tension that has consumed the party.
In fact, I was reading that the Benghazi committee has gone on longer than Watergate. Do I have that right, Robert?
It's gone on pretty long.
Yeah, I saw that same report. Yep.
I mean, Watergate happened quickly, 73, 74. So, yeah, this has been a long experience. And there has, as Trey Gowdy has often told members of Congress. There's not going to be a smoking gun, unlikely to be a smoking gun, which further disappoints the base. And I talk to conservative activists all the time, and they're furious the House hasn't done more. They're not even happy with the committee.
Oh, interesting. I mean, Jim, I realize you're a bit of a partisan here, but nonetheless, has the Benghazi committee and there have been a number of hearings. They haven't found the kind of smoking gun, I guess, that they're looking for. Does this hurt them, do you think?
I don't think this one in particular necessarily hurts them. Again, it plays well to the base for their demand to, you know, to go after Hillary Clinton, as Kevin McCarthy was nice enough to point out a couple days ago. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, to switch slightly to presidential politics, you know, as a reminder, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to make her appearance before the Benghazi committee at the end of October. So this is turning towards a pretty interesting month for her for a lot of different reasons. So again, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I think that, you know, the Benghazi gate is a fraud and a phony, where mistakes were made. People should be held accountable. Congressman Gowdy has been nice enough to point out that he doesn't expect any smoking guns. I share that assessment, but it's part of an ongoing effort to try and cripple Hillary Clinton with a steady series of leaks to try and, again, drive down her favorability and approval ratings.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I see some folks want to join us on Radio Times. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We are talking about what is and, I guess, isn't happening in the U.S. Congress. We'll be talking a bit about the presidential race after this short break, talking with Robert Costa and Jim Manley. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us, WHYY Radio Times. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about John Boehner's exit as Speaker of the House, his likely successor, Kevin McCarthy, the ongoing congressional infighting within the Republican Party. And we'll be talking about what all this means for the 2016 election cycle. And again, our guests are Jim Manley, Director of Communications for QGA Public Affairs, a bipartisan political consulting firm. He served as senior aide to Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, as press secretary for Senator Ted Kennedy. Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. And again, you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bob from Swarthmore to join our conversation. And Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
My question has to do with gerrymandering in the production of a radicalized Republican Party. When you take the pen and redraw congressional districts to protect incumbents, and you essentially homogenize the base, and you lose any possibility for moderation. I'd like to hear what your speakers think of that.
Sure. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jim, how much has gerrymandering created the situation we're in today?
Oh, significant part of it. To be honest, it's more the issue for Republicans, but it's an issue for Democrats as well. So everything your speaker just said, I believe is correct, but let's peel it back one more layer.
Sure.
So what that means under that scenario, what that means is that the only thing that members up for re-election care about is a primary, especially on the Republican side. They don't want to be primaried by a Tea Party type. And so that is one of the reasons why the House Republican Caucus in particular has moved so far to the right, because they have a safe seat because of gerrymandering. So, like I said, the only thing they need to worry about is attacks from the Tea Party type. So they move to the right to protect their flank. So, yes, it's a significant problem. Don't think I can remember the stats off the top of my head, but the bottom line is that very few members in the House, either Republican or Democrat, actually are subject to a significant general election these days. Many members come from relatively safe districts.
Robert, do you want to add to that?
I think he nailed it.
Okay. I like a short, concise answer. We have an email from Paul says, my only comment is that the House Republicans being discussed are anti-government radicals, not conservatives. Robert, should we think of them that way? And I guess we've been focusing largely on the Freedom Caucus, as they call themselves.
Well, one of Speaker Boehner's top allies, the Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes of California, and he often calls these House Freedom Caucus members reactionaries. A fellow Republican has used that term, and many of Boehner's friends do the same, because Boehner sees himself as someone elected to the House in 1990 who was conservative, helped write the Contract for America with Newt Gingrich. He sees himself as conservative. And so it's really a tactical difference, yeah, and not an ideological one. And that's really at the heart of the discussion.
Robert, he seems so happy after announcing his decision to step aside at the end of the month. Is he? I mean, and you had this really interesting article about bumping into him, I guess, shortly after his meeting with the Pope. And this seemed to be such a pivotal moment or event for him.
So I've been covering Speaker Boehner since 2009, and I'm just a reporter, but you get a sense of how people are, seeing them up close in the House and how they operate. And Boehner, whenever he's around, he doesn't stop to talk to reporters. He has a security detail. He rushes by. Maybe he'll wink at you or say hello, but he doesn't talk. And the night before he resigned, he pulled Politico's Jake Sherman, one of my close friends, and I aside and started to reenact this whole moment with the Pope, where the Pope asked him to pray for him. And I just said to myself and to my friend, something's changed with Boehner. I mean, I don't know what's going on. We asked him if he was resigning, but he certainly seemed to be at peace.
Well, and he certainly, I mean, he's known for crying, and it's actually a thing that I think makes him really such an interesting person. But he was really weeping as the Pope was speaking to a joint session of Congress. And many people were wondering, what's up with Boehner?
He's a devout Roman Catholic. You know, one of the things about covering Boehner is you learn he's a man of routine, grew up in a big family in Ohio. And every day he lives on Capitol Hill on the House side. He goes to Pete's Diner for breakfast. He also almost every day goes to Mass. That's the kind of guy he is.
Jim, you worked with him. Anything else you want to add to that?
Not necessarily, you know, except for the fact that, you know, I found it interesting that Senator Reid always allowed him to smoke in his office. Senator Reid hates cigarettes, needless to say. Doesn't care for alcohol, doesn't drink either, but he indulged in both. Again, when I was a staffer working for Senator Kennedy, we'd go over to the House side to negotiate No Child Left Behind. He was just always so warm and gracious. We'd be sitting in the ante room, and he'd plop down. He'd look at us and say, hey, do you guys mind if I smoke? And it was like, well, let's see. It's your ante room. Sure. Go ahead. And then we'd just sit there and shoot the breeze. It was just a fascinating dynamic. So a good man. I've got plenty of criticisms of him, as you've already heard, but he's a good man, and he will be missed.
Robert, let me just throw out a couple of names and then we'll get back to our callers. And what's interesting with the Republicans, of course, the three leading presidential candidates, Trump, Fiorina, and Carson, none of them have ever been elected to office before. What is their appeal, would you say, as you understand Republican voters at this juncture in the presidential election?
One of the appeals is when you look at Trump and you look at Carson, they really have a populist message on the economy. There's a sense with the Republican base that the donor class, the Wall Street types, have taken too much control of the party. There's a revulsion against it. There's a real anger at the Republican leadership in Washington, as we've discussed, for not doing enough in divided government during the Obama era. And there's anyone with elected experience, it's a tar, it's a curse upon them. And you've seen Bush and Walker and Rick Perry and so many others just trying to deal with this roiling sentiment. And it's hard to stop it because it's there and it's been simmering for years.
But the fact that, you know, there's been much, probably too much focused on Trump, but his name calling, the fact that his budget that he announced earlier this week really doesn't add up. Yesterday he said he would deport all Syrian refugees if he became president. I mean,
and he got a huge cheer for
it. He did. I mean, do you think, Robert, these people will pull the lever for him, or he's just allowing them to express whatever frustration they have?
So the most vivid memory I have of this entire campaign was when I was in Mobile, Alabama, about a month ago for a Trump rally, and he was at this football stadium, probably about 20,000 people there. And the crowd was not your normal Ted Cruz conservative activist types. This crowd was full of white-collar professionals, teachers, insurance salesmen from all around Alabama. And I said to myself, and I, as I went through the crowd, why are these people here? They're sick of not only politics, they're sick of the culture. They talked about political correctness. They can't stand it. They feel like when they're in their offices and in their workplaces, they can't say what's really on their mind. And so they don't really care what Trump says, if it's inflammatory, if it's absurd, because they think at least he's saying what he believes, and they think they can't. And I don't know if that makes political sense, but that's something I've detected everywhere I've gone to cover Trump.
Jim, what do you make of his candidacy so far?
Especially on Robert's last riff, I agree with him 100%. I see a general revulsion against the political process, leaders in particular, and I see a lot of Americans concerned about the future, confused about where we're going as a country, and they're lashing out and latching on to a guy that I consider a clown, nothing more, nothing less, albeit a dangerous one. So I will admit that months ago, was very quick to dismiss his candidacy. I was amongst the punditry, if you will, who predicted a quick flame out. I'm done predicting that. Let's put it that way. I have no idea how this is going to play out.
Let me see.
I've got a lot of money after all.
Let me see what Joe from Fishtown has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marcy. Now
it's Marty, but that's okay. No, go ahead, Joe.
With the Citizens United decision, I think that Planned Parenthood is now could be considered a person. And in the Constitution, Section 9, it states quite clearly that no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed, meaning you can't call out one group or one person and make a bill or a law and exclude them without due process, a judicial trial.
Mm-hmm.
Or they have to have a criminal act that had occurred, which has not been the case. And even with the defunding of abortion by Planned Parenthood, that's also probably wrong, particularly now with the Citizens United decision.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. Jim, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
No. I mean, yes, except for to say I need to say that's an interesting idea that I'm going to have to look into. I mean, the boundaries are.
Nobody's mentioned it.
Well, you did, and we appreciate that. No, thanks for calling, Joe.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'll have to look into it. I mean, the boundaries are being pushed so far vis-a-vis, the Citizens United that I guess nothing would surprise me, but I have to tell you that this is the first I've heard of it, but I'm going to look into it.
Well, Robert, we haven't really talked about all the money that's been flowing into the presidential race so far. I'm sure it'll break whatever records were broken the last go around. How much do you think money is also creating this the political campaign or environments or for this presidential campaign? I didn't put that very succinctly.
Well, I think people watch the rise of the super PACs and they see not just a new political action committee emerging. They're seeing moneyed interests, special interest groups exerting their power in new in ways that extend their tentacles far beyond where they have gone before without as much disclosure. That disgruntles people. They see themselves as having less of an economic opportunity, less power with themselves as an individual. And so the super PAC has, I think, had a fundamental foundational effect on the race in ways we haven't really even comprehended yet as reporters. Two, I think the super PACs, they haven't been proven to be as powerful as we thought they would be to sustain campaigns. Rick Perry, Scott Walker, they had super PACs with millions. There's still millions in their super PACs, yet they decided to leave the race. Hard dollars, real campaign money still matters.
And what about Jeb Bush? I mean, a year ago, everyone was saying, you know, he would be the candidate, that he could prove, I guess, what his family had said about him all along was that he was of presidential timber. Robert?
He may still be. He has a lot of money, and he has the many people who support him within the party. And if this outsider surge ever fades, I think Bush, John Kasich, or Senator Rubio will be there to catch it, perhaps, and become more of a traditional Republican nominee. But Bush hasn't adjusted to the Trump effect in terms of becoming more candid, become more loose on the trail. Trump has changed the whole race. And Bush is politically rusty, hasn't been in office since January 2007, hasn't adjusted to a world that's really full throttle, fast-paced, 24/7, not the genteel politics, if that's the word, from 2005, 2006.
What do you think, Jim?
Again, I largely agree with everything Robert just said, and especially his identification of the three people that could, in fact, and or will benefit if when Trump fades. I am continue to be mystified by Governor Bush's attachment to his family name and his brother in particular. As a liberal partisan Democrat, you know, I can spend hours talking to you about what I believe was, you know, the Bush administration's manipulation of the intelligence that led us to the war in Iraq. And for him to stand up there and say that his brother kept him kept this country safe, I just find fascinating for a lot of different reasons. But it's indicative to me, as Robert just said, he is blind to the current political current political dynamic, and his chops are really rusty, and he needs to get up his game very quickly, or he's going to fade away.
How about, we're almost out of time here, Jim, but how about Hillary Clinton's last name? Has that hurt her?
Oh, sure. No doubt about it. Despite the fact that I worked for Senator Kennedy for 13 years, with that long family name, that dynasty, if you will. Right. But in this day and age, I think that folks are a lot more skeptical about this. And you got to earn the right to be president. And that's one of the dynamics she's faced with. But yes, she is, someone I've known, I used to know well when I was worked for the Labor Committee. I spent a lot of time with her in the committee process, the hearings and whatnot. She's a very warm, very gracious, very smart person, but she's a very polarizing figure, due in part to her last name. Yes.
Robert, almost out of time, so it's grassroots versus dynasties, just picking up on what you both were talking about.
It is, and that is something that is driving the entire campaign on both sides, Senator Sanders versus Clinton, Bush versus the rest. There's an appetite for something new, but in the end, you can't count out dynasties. Votes don't happen until February 1st. There's a lot of time between now and then.
Well, Robert Costa, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. National political reporter for The Washington Post joined us from the studios of The Washington Post. Jim Manley, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Sure, my pleasure.
And he's director of communications for QGA Public Affairs, a bipartisan political consulting firm. Ballot Talks on Radio Times, something we do every Thursday at this time, talking about politics, election politics, and important issues that matter to us all. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, also how to download a podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.